Thank you. So this week, chapter 4 of Bhikkhuvedi's In the Buddha's Words, this week, the happiness visible in this present life. And so this one is focusing mainly on questions of harmony and people how to live happily in this life, and has mainly some practical guidance, and especially focusing on the needs of the lay community. And so it provides ample opportunity both for monastic cynicism and also for feminist criticism. So hopefully we'll be able to enjoy this afternoon. Good session. But, okay. It's a bit of a long chapter, and so I've just selected a few of the passages here. And for those of you who've read it or are familiar with the material, I'm going to skip over quite a few suttas, because there's a lot in here. So please request any, if there's any that you're interested in or you want to talk about any. And that applies for each week as well, not just this particular week. I just choose which ones appeal to me for one reason or another. Now this one is the Sigalovada Sutta of the Digha Nikaya. I had a bit of a problem this afternoon because the access to insight was down, so it's only just come back online, so it's difficult to get translations. Also, MetaNet was another source of translation, seems to have disappeared. The domain name's expired. Anyway. Okay, here is the Sigalovada Sutta correspondences, and as is fairly normal for the Digha Nikaya Suttas, the long collection, it's fairly common that they will have several cognate suttas. So this particular one has one copy cognate in the Dirgha Agama belonging to the... Thanks, that's good.
Speak up, what?
Dhammaguptaka school, which was located
in China.
Before it was in China, was located
in the.
Be careful.
Buddhist culture.
No, that was wrong. It's not in Buddhist culture.
It was in the Greek culture.
Gandhara.
Yeah, yeah, very good. Yeah, it's a Greek culture.
Northwest.
Greekish, anyway, Greek Indo-Greek culture. And was probably the original text was probably written in the
Words.
There is. Oh, Wikipedia. Gandhari language. Okay?
Which is
characterized by
words.
Okay, we'll do that. Look at that next week. Gandhari is actually a back formation of a name for the region. Obviously, this is the language of the Gandharan region, and is the name which has been given in recent years to the texts found in that region which have a distinctive language. The original one, the most famous one, being a particular version of the Dhammapada, called the Gandhari Dhammapada. And it seems that that was probably the language used by the Dharmaguptaka school generally. We can't actually figure that out specifically in the case of the Dirgha Agama. There are different opinions about that, but it seems to have been the language of the school. These two, T16 and T17, are two independent suttas in the Taisho Tripitaka. That means they were brought over to China sometime, translated, but not included in any of the major collections. So they're just kind of floating loose. Okay, and this one is, of course, in the Madhyama Agama of the Sarvastivadins. And two Sanskrit fragments. Blah blah, he's getting from the Madhyama Agama. So again, Madhyama Agama and from Turfan. Okay, in Sanskrit. Alright. So they're the corresponding suttas. A bit disorganized, I couldn't find the. Okay. So.
Yeah.
Yes, this is a very quite a famous introduction, translated by our friend, John Kelly. This is what I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, its squirrel sanctuary. Then Sigalika, the householder's son, having got up early and gone out of Rajagaha, was paying homage with wet clothes and hair and with joined palms to the different directions, east, south, west, and north, lower, and upper. Meanwhile, the Buddha dressed himself in the early morning, took his bowl and robe, and went into Rajagaha on alms round. On the way, he saw Sigalika worshipping the six directions. Seeing this, he said to him, "Young man, why have you risen in the early morning and set out from Rajagaha to worship in such a way?" He said, "Dear sir, my father on his deathbed..." What is dear sir? Bhante? Yeah, it says dear sir. Bhante is a translator. Bhante, there you go. Here's another suggestion. We have a discussion of titles. We can have dear sir.
Dear sir.
Dear madam. Okay, my son, my father on his deathbed urged me. Okay, Kalan Karanto, as he was literally, the idiom is Kalan Karanto, as he was making his time, literally. My son, you must worship the directions. So there's a realizing, respecting, honoring, worshipping, and holding sacred my father's request, I have risen in the early morning and set out from Rajagaha to worship in this way. Okay? This is an interesting rendering here. They use realizing for Sakkaronto. Now, this is Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as revere. These are just a set of synonyms, actually. The reason they've translated it that way is because the word Sakkaronto, Karonto is to make, and Sat is from the root to be. So to make real, literally to realize. I've chosen a very literal rendering there. The applied meaning is to worship something. To worship something is to make it real. Interesting. Karoti can be is to do, yeah? But sakkaronti is to literally to make real. Okay. Then the Buddha said, "Young man, that's not how the six directions should be worshipped according to the discipline of the noble ones." Okay, so this is the term that's often used in the early suttas. I missed out that bit. I'm copying and pasting. This is Arya Vinaya, and this is the word which is usually used in one of the words that's used to describe the Buddhist path, the Arya Vinaya. And the actual sutra itself then goes on to talk about a whole lot of different things which Bhikkhu Bodhi's omitted, and I'll also omit. It gets a little bit too long, but well worth reading. This particular sutra is sometimes called the Gihi Vinaya, the Vinaya for the householder, and gives some nice examples of teachings for lay guidance. But this is one of the most famous passages, and this is the passage where it directly answers the questions about how one worships the six directions, the Chadisa. So these six directions should be known, mother and father, as the east. So it's Mata Pitaro. Yeah. The teachers as the south. Acharya, okay. The spouse and family, Puttadara, okay. Friend and colleagues as the north, Mittamacha. Workers and servants as the lower direction, Hikmadisa, Dasa Kamakara. Dasa is kamakara, is like, literally like doer of work, and dasa is a slave, or is usually translated as slave. But always in thinking of the institution of slavery in ancient India, it's very different from how it was set up in the West. So much so that when the Megasthenes came to India, in his report back to Greece, he said that in the time of Chandragupta, just 100 years after the Buddha, he reported that there were no slaves in India. Okay, so he was unable to recognize the institution of slavery from his Greek experience in India. It was a kind of bonded labourer. They certainly didn't have their freedom, but there certainly were a lot of, as you see here, they basically had what we would think of as quite reasonable set of rights for workers, even though they didn't have the right to freedom. And ascetics and Brahmins as the upper direction, Samana Brahmana. Okay, in five ways, and then it shows how to do worship each one of these things rather than doing the putting on wet clothes and hair and bowing down to the directions. In five ways should a mother and father be worshipped and be respected as a child by a child. So he should think, or they should think, I will support them who supported me, I will do my duty to them, I will maintain the family lineage and tradition, and I will be worthy of my inheritance, and I will make donations on behalf of dead ancestors. Okay. Okay, so the idea of making offerings on behalf of the Paitas, or the departed, predates Buddhism, obviously. It's worth noting that in this word, the word Paita is quite ambiguous. The literal meaning of it is departed. Okay, it's the root is I, meaning to go. It's past participle, meaning gone, and pa means out in this case. So those who've gone out, literally. So literally the departed. And it was used as a term, generally speaking, of the departed in the same way that we use it. And that sort of becomes a bit confused with the Buddhist usage, where it becomes identified with one particular realm of existence of the hungry ghosts, the pretas. But the earlier usage, it simply meant the departed. All right? And the mother and father, so respected, reciprocate with compassion in five ways. By restraining you from wrongdoing, by guiding you towards good actions, by training you in a profession, supporting the choice of a suitable spouse, pati rupena dharena sanyojenti. Interesting that they've translated that as support. Find a suitable wife. The word itself is yuj, to the yoke, or so to connect, and it's a causative form, so to make you connected with a suitable wife is the literal translation. Yeah, it's a dara, yeah. Dara is a wife. Okay?
The left hand.
He's done a PC. Yeah, that's right, yeah. So, whether that means an arranged marriage or not, but probably it doesn't really imply an arranged marriage, just to support the process. Okay. And in due time, handing over the inheritance. Okay? So then five ways in which the teachers, so in this way the eastern direction is protected and made peaceful and secure. In five ways should teachers as the southern direction be respected by a student, by rising for them. Okay. Rising for them, that means getting up when they walk into the room. This is a gesture of respect. Especially in, so we still do that, especially in formal situations. That if a senior teacher walks into the room, that we will rise out of respect. Regularly attending lessons, eagerly desiring to learn. Duly serving them, paricharyaya, and receiving instructions, competently receiving instructions. So these are duties of a student. And teachers so respected reciprocate in compassion in five ways. They will training in self-discipline, suvinitan vinenti. They will ensuring the teachings are well grasped, sugahitan gahapenti. Instructing in every branch of knowledge, sabhasiptasutan. Okay. Introducing their friends and colleagues. And providing safeguards in every direction. Interesting. Paritas. Making paritas in every direction. And so interesting that one of the duties of the teacher is to introduce you to their friends, so the system of academic life doesn't seem to have changed all that much. So that's what you know. Okay, so in five ways should a wife, as the Western direction, be respected by her husband? And by, here we go, by honouring, by not disrespecting, not looking down on her, by being faithful, okay, not committing adultery. So this one is, the literal translation is this is from Charya, to conduct, ati Charya, ati means over the top, excessive. So not by, literally by not going too far. Sharing authority. Or literally, it doesn't actually quite say sharing authority. It's interesting, the Pali Isarya. Isara is the word that's used for God. Right? So God is the Isara. And so Isarya is the literally the godliness, or in this case the authority is a reasonable rendering of it. But it doesn't say sharing it actually. It says vosadga means giving up. So the husband should give up authority to the wife. Alankaranupadanena, and by giving gifts, actually it's a bit more, it means more by giving jewellery and things like that. How's Bhikkhubodhi translate? Providing with adornments. Alankara. Of course, being very essential for Indian women. So, worshipped and wife thus ministered to by her husband will reciprocate by well organizing her work. Susangvihita kamanta. By being kind to the servants.
It says in-laws and household workers.
In-laws and household workers, yeah. What have we got here? Harijana. In-laws and household servants. Yeah, not being unfaithful. Yeah, this is, it says, I think the word is parijana. Literally means the folk around. Jana is the folk, pari means around, so it means those around. So I guess perhaps they're working from a commentarial explanation there. But I would guess that's meant to be the intended meaning is if she's the like the head of the household, then to be kindly towards those who are under her authority in the household. By not committing adultery. By protecting stores, okay. Looking after the, looking after the supplies, especially the rice and essential food and things like that in the kitchen. That's very crucial. And being skillful and skillful and diligent in all of her duties. So this is how the husband and wife should look after each other. See, in some ways, have to be kind of adjusted, but I think it's still it's useful to know how the Buddha responded in these kinds of circumstances. Yeah, and in that case, it wasn't, you know, he was very, like, the context, you know, he's very much responding to what Sigala, where he was at, what he was doing, you know, so he's sort of building on that context. So I think that's also quite a good,
recent mistake.
A prescription for lay life.
Well, mm-hmm. Like, if
yeah. Yeah, yeah, it is. Yeah.
But then, I think you couldn't go all that wrong by following this.
Mm. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, it's not. But I get your point. It's not like prescriptive. It's saying when for people who are living in this kind of context, then this is how to manage that. Yeah, it's not challenging the parameters of that context. It's not telling Sigala Vaida how to live and saying, well, this is your life and this is a good way to live it. Yeah. Yeah. We'll find a few similar things in the thing here. I mean, he doesn't necessarily say that you're actually, you know, literally benefiting the departed in that way, but it may be, yeah, maybe just keeping up the traditions, you know, keeping up the traditions of the family and the culture. I'm not sure. It doesn't say there, yeah. But that you do find a few mentions like this where it is talking in a Brahmanical context, and so the Buddha was sort of trying to work within that context as much as possible. So, but you don't find it in context where it's more of a specifically Buddhist thing. Yeah. But it also is important to remember, because sometimes some Buddhists can be too dogmatic in these things, and like actually, you know, saying, oh, you know, say in Malaysia, sometimes people were saying, oh, you know, you shouldn't have the you know, in Chinese homes to have the household shrine. They're saying, oh, it's un-Buddhist to have this kind of thing, and so on. And so that's kind of going a bit too far. And you know, usually they have like a spirit house or something like this, and nobody takes them all that seriously, you know. But you just kind of put a little bit of rice there or something like that, and it's, you know, it's just a kind of a nice sort of connection thing. So sort of to remember that from a Buddhist point of view, we don't have to feel threatened by that or kind of dogmatic about getting rid of it. If you don't want to have it, you don't have it. But if somebody wants to do that, that's all right.
Is there any significance about him being killed?
Oh, that's part of the ritual kind of requirement. Yeah, because it's the ritual bathing thing, yeah?
Yeah.
It seems to me the way the city was going, he was sort of doing his thing by rote, because that's what they do.
Yeah.
And the Buddha's giving him some things to reflect on.
Mm.
He's not saying don't do it, but
Do
it then, do it wisely.
So. And friends and colleagues should be respected by generosity, dana, by paya vaja, kind words, by acting for their welfare, atacharya,
impartiality, samanatataya, and honesty, abhisamvadataya. There's more words you can find, not by not twisted words or something like that, not deceitful words. And when you should reciprocate to those in five ways. Respected, they reciprocate with compassion in five ways. By protecting you when you're vulnerable, and protecting your wealth, being a refuge when you're afraid, not abandoning you in misfortunes, and honouring all your descendants. Okay. In five ways should workers and servants, as the lower direction, be respected by an employer. Okay, by allocating work according to aptitude, yatha balang kammanta sangvidhanena, not literally by aptitude, but by strength, by capacity, not giving them work that's too hard. Providing wages and food, bhata vetananupadanena, looking after the sick, gilanupatyanena, and so that doesn't just mean giving them time off work when sick, it actually means attending to them while they're sick. Yeah? The word is the same word, upatthana, and it's the same word that's used for the services that, say, a student will provide to a teacher, upatthaka. So it means actually attending to their sick bed, getting them medicines, cleaning them, all of those kinds of things. Sharing special treats, acharyam rasanam sangi bhagena. Okay. And giving them special delicacies, and from time to time giving them days off. So that's not too bad, is it? Quite good.
Yeah.
John Howard's got a thing or two to learn here. So, workers and servants, so respected, reciprocate with compassion in five ways. Okay. Being willing to start early and finish late when necessary.
It's very different
from
the
components. What does Ricardo have? Get up before, yeah, that's more literal, yeah? Get up, pubatayino, chahanti, achanipatino. Yeah, that's what literally what it says, is getting up before and going to bed afterwards. Yeah. Taking only what is given, dinadayino cha. No, we discussed this yesterday, and not nicking for. Things don't change very much, do you? You know, kind of nicking from your employers has been going on for a long, long time. Doing work well, sukata kamakara, and promote gitti vanahara, literally carrying a good word around. So praising the employer if they're looking after you and speaking well of them. So again, that's pretty good, isn't it? So in five ways should ascetic and Brahmins as the upper direction be respected by kindly metena kaya kamena, metena vachi kamena, metena mano kamena, by thoughts and speech and action of metta. By having an open door, anavata dwarataya, okay, by not closing the door to them, and by looking after their material needs, or providing their material needs. And then they will, ascetics and Brahmins so respected, reciprocate with compassion in six ways. And so again, you know, notice it is talking about Samana Brahmana, so this of course is not specifically a Buddhist context, but any kind of religious leaders or whatever. Leading away from evil, promoting what's good, similar to the teachers were providing, or the parents, was it? Yeah, they're similar to the parents' guidance. Where are we? Okay, thinking compassionately, teaching you what you haven't learnt before. Asutam Sarventi. Literally making you hear the unheard. Clarifying what you already know, the heard pariyoda penti, clarifying, and showing you the path to heaven. Sagasamargan atikanti. In this way, the upper direction is protected and made secure. That's the Sikalavada Sutta, and there's also much other information about other aspects of lay conduct and so on, and so well worth reading and good advice to bear in mind. Alright.
Interesting that the Buddha sets up a framework for harmonious relations in May life by speaking of reciprocal responsibilities.
Right.
There's no rights there.
Yeah. Not what you should expect, but what you should do.
Why are we talking about
6 directions? 1, 2, 3, 4, up and down. Yeah, you find that quite commonly. Yeah. Sorry? Okay. Yeah, you have different ones. You have the four directions, and then you have the 4 plus 2 is the 6, and then you have the 8 directions is the 4 directions and the in-between directions, northeast and north, southwest, and so on. And then you have the 10 directions, the 8 plus 2. Okay, so the next one is the Samacitta Sutta, about respect for mother and father. And it's also quite a nice and quite unforgettable sutta, this one. And again, a few cognate suttas, this one belonging to the Akotara Agama of the... You sure about that?
Okay.
You sure? Mm-hmm. How come you're so sure and yet... And yet... No, actually it's uncertain identification. Mahasangika, yeah. I know in history of mindfulness I just put it was Mahasangika. I think I've made a note somewhere that it's actually description's uncertain. This is more or less parallel to the Anguttara. T141 Chinese, another partial parallel, a kind of loose sutta somewhere. Majjhima Sansutta, and then a couple of Sanskrit fragments. I'm just seeing if I've got a translation here. He started out, this first one is it's a different sutta. This is the actual sutta here. There are these two people who are not easy to repay. Which two? Your mother and father. Interesting. My Bhikkhu Bodhi here has one can never repay, but Tanisra here is much more accurate. Literally, it's natsupatikaran. Not easy to repay. Which two? Mother and father. Even if you were to carry your mother on one shoulder and your father on the other shoulder for 100 years, and were to look after them by anointing, massaging, bathing, and rubbing their limbs. And interestingly enough, the commentary on this point here says that you should, if you carry your mother on one shoulder and your father on the other shoulder, you should put your mother on the shoulder of on the right shoulder, which is the place of highest respect. If you were to look after them by anointing, massaging, bathing, and rubbing their limbs, and they were to defecate and urinate right there on your shoulders, you could not in that way pay or repay your parents.
Well, that's quite different from the Kabbalists.
Yes.
I mean, he's not quite explicit about them doing it on the shoulders.
They should void their excrements there. If you were to establish your mother and father in absolute sovereignty over this great earth abounding in the 7 treasures, you would not in that way repay your parents. Okay, this is a good one to mention to mum and dad. If I ask them why you become ordained. Mother and father do much for their children. They care for them, they nourish them, they introduce them to this world. But anyone who rouses his unbelieving mother and father, settles and establishes them in faith, is conviction, saddha, rouses and establishes them in virtue, and gets their stingy mum and dad and establishes them in generosity, and rouses their foolish mum and dad and establishes them in wisdom. To this extent, one pays and repays one's mother and father.
Alright.
Yeah, you've got to be careful about that. But it's only if you actually do that, not if you preach to them about it, is it a different kind of matter? Okay, so then there's a few others. Isn't one about the four kinds of marriage? I won't go into that one. But then this one is one I quite like about the Samajivi Sutta. The Buddha saying in Sumsumara Giri, Crocodile Mountain. His crocodile haunt. Then, early in the morning, the Blessed One put on his robes, carrying his bowl and outer robe, went to the home of the household of Nakula's father. He sat down on the seat. Nakula's father and Nakula's mother went to the... This is a common way of naming that they would use. That the parents would be known after the name of the son. Nakula's father said to the Blessed One, Lord, ever since Nakula's mother as a young girl was brought to me to bring my wife when I was just a young boy, I am not conscious of being unfaithful to her even in mind, much less in body. We want to see one another not only in the present life but also in the life to come. Okay? So not only we wish Icheyama Diteva Cheva Dame, okay, so in this very life to see each other, and Abhisamparaya in the future life, Anyamanyam Pasitun, literally to see each other, to see one another. And Nakula's mother said, ever since a young girl I was brought to Nakula's father to be his wife, I was not conscious of being unfaithful to him even in mind, much less in body. And she says the same thing. So if both husband and wife want to see each other not only in the present life but also in the life to come, they should be in tune with each other in conviction. In tune. Samasadha. Yeah, so he's used this word samasadha. Same, literally is same or even. If both are same. Tanisha has used this because he says that summer, this word summer, and summer is used as a word for literally for tuning instruments in musical theory, so he's sort of riffing off that. Then they will see each other not only in the present life but also in the life to come. So the same sadha, okay, summer sadha, same faith, summer sila, same precepts. Samachaga, same generosity. Okay, so you see all of these things do cause a lot of friction in families and marriages. You know, one partner likes to, you know, get drunk and all this kind of stuff, and then the other one doesn't. Or if one's very generous and one's very stingy, that causes a lot of conflict. And samapanya, similar intelligence.
In here, it's a samachaga, and it's also in the dhammachaka you have chaga. So, is this the same meaning?
It's the same word, yeah.
It means
basically giving up.
Giving up.
Yeah, so in the Dhammacakka Sutta, when it's part of the definition for nibbana, is chaga, which is like giving up everything. Yeah, chaga, parinisago.
In this context, meaning?
Same as dana.
Same as dana.
Yeah, it just means giving. Yeah. Okay, so this one's just a nice one to bear in mind, because sometimes in the monastic lifestyle we get a bit cynical about marriage and things like that, and not speaking personally, of course. And
do you encourage marriage?
Well, you take the Buddha's attitude here is that yeah, I mean, in some cases you do, yeah, why not? You
know, is he encouraging marriage here, though? Or is he just saying if you want to be born together?
Yeah, but he's not saying, oh well, you know, they say we want to see each other in their next life. He doesn't say, oh, you're just attached to each other, learn to let go. No, he's telling them, well, if that's what you want, then this is how to do it. Yeah, and so he's actually facilitating them, because it's not an unwholesome wish. Yeah, if they were to then ask him, you know, well, this wish of ours to see each other in the next life, is that going to make us happy forever? And then he'd say, of course, no. Well, no, it's not. You know. So it depends on how to respond to the circumstances. But if a married couple comes and they want to talk about these things, then you know that's a very skillful response. You know, but definitely I think that for many people, living the married life is definitely the best thing. Yeah.
We get by with that,
don't we? Yeah, absolutely. Oh. Okay. So, with that. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. And so, you have a similar one with one of the next suttas is the present welfare and future welfare. The Kolian family man, Diga Janu, approaches. He says, we are lay people who enjoy sensual pleasures, dwelling at home in a bed crowded with children. It doesn't mean what you think, all right? Enjoying fine sandalwood, wearing garland scents and unguents, accepting gold and silver. Let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma to us in a way that will lead to our welfare and happiness, both in the present life and the future life. And so again, you know, Buddha's job in that context to say, well, listen, you should be practicing letting go and so on. But he gives them some practical advice. He says, well, practice persistent effort, protection, looking after your wealth properly, good friendship, and balanced living. Means so that your income doesn't, so your expenditure doesn't exceed your income. And then four things for the happiness in the life beyond is faith, moral discipline, sila, generosity, and wisdom. Okay. So, yeah. Asalayana Sutta. Okay. Yeah. That's what is that? Okay. Good. So just to briefly mention a couple of things in before we get to the Asalayana Sutta that's mentioned here. One is on the wrong livelihood for lay people. So this is an important list to know. Five kinds of wrong livelihood for lay people. One is trading in weapons, trading in living beings, trading in meat, trading in intoxicants, and trading in poisons. Okay, so there's three or five kinds of wrong livelihood. I guess we can all think of other kinds of wrong livelihood, but that's a pretty, not such a bad list if you think about it.
What would be some modern examples of wrong livelihood?
Oh, slave trade?
That's trading in humans.
Oh, you mean that aren't there? That aren't included within that?
Yeah.
Any suggestions? Kinds of wrong livelihood that aren't included in those five? Working in the advertising industry?
Sure.
That'd be intoxicating. Yeah?
That sounds pretty cool.
And the poison?
Sometimes journalism.
sometimes journalism. Well, some of those things, you know, they can be used well or badly. Yeah, I mean, you can use journalism well.
Chasing
paparazzi. Yeah, paparazzism is being a celebrity fan. Yeah.
What about prostitution?
Yeah.
Would that be trading and living?
No. Trading and living means is, I mean, obviously, yeah, selling. Selling sex slavery obviously would be, yeah. It's not included.
Well, they worked. It seems not.
It's a bit of a it's one where there's a kind of an ambiguity, because one of what it also says and is generally kind of accepted is that also wrong livelihoods are any livelihood that involve breaking the five precepts. So anything that you do where you're going to end up lying or stealing things or whatever is, or killing, is going to be wrong. And of course, with prostitution, it's pretty hard to avoid breaking the third precept.
How's that?
Well, you could make sure that your clients were only unmarried.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a bit difficult to.
Because it's a temporary wife. They call a temporary wife, I believe, using the Indian language. Temporary wife.
Oh, that's different. Yeah.
So it would be breaking the precept.
But there is sutras
where the Buddha has well-respected disciple, lay disciples, who aren't called out, but rather kind of, it's low-level prostitution. Because courtesan is quite different. Because if you're a courtesan, you're openly out there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if a man's saying you're a courtesan, it's open. So, and also it's a status symbol, so you could be a courtesan and not break the third precept, because your clients would be openly with you.
Also, you wouldn't break the third. You don't need to break the precept if you're married.
Of course.
If that's your livelihood, that's what you do. So, you know, why would it be breaking a precept?
Oh, but you're encouraging the men to break the precepts.
In the chain.
Yeah. So encouraging the men to break this. Well, I don't know. Do they need that much?
Do they need it?
In the Chinese tradition, they say that being a funeral director is wrong livelihood.
Really?
Because they believe that you're waiting for people to die in order so that you can make your livelihood. That's what they say.
Because it's like saying, you know, by being a funeral director, you're encouraging people to die. By being a prostitute, you're encouraging people to commit adultery.
Yeah.
So.
Doing the deepest, though, they have to die. Also, prostitutes don't ask for marriage.
But also, there's another idea, I think, which is not really mentioned so much in the sutras, but maybe it's more relevant these days, is the fact that engaging in particular things actually supports those people who engage in wrong livelihood. So say, for instance, if you are actively buying lots of meat, then you are supporting people. While going to the butcher, you're supporting people who are
engaging
in wrong livelihood. So what does that mean? If you support people who engage in wrong livelihood, does that mean that you yourself are creating unwholesome karma by doing that?
Yeah.
So
it's pretty neat. Difficult, if not impossible, not
to
support people.
Yeah, I mean that argument is a very powerful one. One of the issues with it is that it always has a lot of boundary issues. Like if you say I don't want to support anyone, for example, I don't want to support people who meat industry, because this is why I used to be an animal lives, so we used to discuss these things all the time. Okay, so I don't want to I want to eat meat. It's wrong. Okay, that's fine. Cheese. Well, milk kind of maybe not, but they kill, you know, the cows and they kill the calves and blah blah blah. But you know, maybe you can let that through. But then it's got rennet in it, so I'm not going to have rennet. But then what about other things? For example, sugar, which apparently, at least when I was there, they said that every state in Australia, the sugar was actually filtered through charred animal bones at a certain point in the production of sugar. When they burn the cane fields, when they spray pesticides on all the crops, actually every vegetable crop, just about, they're spraying pesticides everywhere. Even if they're not spraying pesticides, the trucks are driving along the road, squashing insects as they drive.
We should add vegetables too, don't they?
Yeah.
But you see what I'm talking about. It's a direct link. Obviously, there's a lot of indirect links.
Yeah.
In the case of, buying vegetables, of course, is helping indirect links involved with killing, but there's a direct link with buying meat because that is the person who's engaged in wrong livelihood directly, and you buy from them. You buy their product, which gives them the support for what they're doing.
Yeah. It's just a bit. I mean, I agree with that in principle, but it's just. There's always these kind of grey areas, the kind of the directness or indirectness of it is it's sort of a gradual movement. I mean, the position that I came to that I ended up being comfortable with that was to think of it in terms of purchasing is not. It's not regarded as something which is inherently unethical, but it's regarded as something which somebody could make a choice to use their political or economic power to try to influence things in a better direction. Yeah? So it's something which is an individual choice. And so some people choose to say, well, I'm not going to have meat, I'll have vegetables for various reasons, or you might say, I'm not going to buy from Nestle because they do terrible things in the third world. I'm not going to buy from McDonald's or whatever. And so it's a process of essentially boycotting things which you believe are unethical. And so as a consumer choice.
But it's also important to not seek a Puritan position, but to see that there are choices in a range, and it's better to be directing your actions towards the good. Or the better, rather than the absolute good.
Yeah.
And everybody's got different choices available to them.
Yeah.
And what this sort of is a good essay on this.
Okay.
So that's where he pointed out, I think it's published in the magazine, which might be pointed out that Buddhists who develop guilt complex over wanting to be perfect environmentalists,
boycott capital.
Capitalism,
yeah. I think that's part of the message of that story of the Bodhisattva and look at seeing just the ploughing of the fields and seeing the kind of cutting up the insects and things like that. Yeah.
I was thinking about the fact that I was incredibly relieved by my middle life. Because it's impossible.
Yeah.
So that's, it's not that you're guilty for being part of society, but then you can be active.
To make a choice to do it. And I think it's also good to just to try to think of, you know, innovative ways or to do that. And say one thing Ewan was into a year or two ago, I'm not sure if he's followed it through, but he had this idea that Whenever he saw animals used in advertising, he would contact the advertisers or the company and ask them whether they'd paid the animals. Yeah? And he would say, well, they should, you know, equivalent, because they're selling their product, they should equivalent amount of money that they would have paid an actor, they should give to the World Wildlife Fund, yeah, or something like that. And so he did that a few times, and some of them were saying, oh, well, yeah, that's not a bad idea. Right? And so something like that, maybe they just hadn't thought of it. It's actually quite good for the company. They can just put a little thing, blah, 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 at the bottom that they've given the money to the World Wildlife Fund. It's good publicity for them. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Things like that, I think, is quite good.
Well, everybody can be reassured that all of the herbs from Africa, no insect diet.
That's very good.
When you were walking in, did you see?
No, I put a little sitting
stone. Feel free to rest.
Okay. Okay, so I had a request for the SLA and sort of thing. Where is that?
Those people who are doing violence and doing games are also having a wrong
attitude. Oh, that's an interesting question.
Which
violence? Violent computer games. That's
Was it good to take an actor's concept?
Yeah. Actors?
The hell of laughter.
It's pretty obvious.
Yeah,
it's a good
decision. Yeah, look, computer games. Well, I mean, again, I kind of would think that that it would depend on the nature of the thing, you know? And I don't know, I've never, you know, I haven't used computer games since Space Invaders, so.
It's a bit changed since
then. Yeah?
They say computer games have your hand-eye coordination.
Yeah, they say it does, yeah. So, I mean, there's different views on the effects that it has, and I'm sure that it does have good effects and bad effects.
But we have some good ones for some computer game
editing. Yeah, in Korea they have, yeah.
Yeah.
Some people die from them.
Some people die from them. They're so good that they can't.
Yeah, but there are degrees, and there are things that they do that there's better and worse examples of computer games, you know. I mean, there's when we went to Trent's house, they had a golf game, you know, something like that. That's fairly harmless. But the degree of violence that you introduce into it, yeah, it's hard to say.
Well, the whole.
The thing is actually poisoning the mind of the children.
Yeah. See, it's hard to say because, you know, I mean, just, you know, my example, when I was a kid, I always used to play war games constantly, yeah? I watched war movies and, you know, wanted to be, you know, in the Air Force or something like that, you know?
But research, I've read not a lot, but I've read things in New Scientist, but actually being involved, physically involved in computer game, like, because your target comes up and you shoot it.
Yeah.
That's exactly the same way as, a similar way that soldiers are trained.
The US Marines developed that a few years ago to decrease sensitivity, so the kill rate is higher.
Yeah, because that's the biggest. I was reading some other research where, up until they introduced the different types of training regimes, most bullets were wasted because most people missed what they wanted to miss, because it's really, really hard to get people to shoot at somebody. But computer games are desensitising. Imagine if it's affecting their mind and people. I mean, I don't know anything about computer. I was quite shocked when I read these articles and research that have been done on computer games.
I think those kinds of things probably need to be combined with other conditions and factors in order to create a natural negative outcome. So it's a bit like, you know, eating sugar on its own won't make you sick, but if you ate a lot of sugar plus saturated fats all the time, then you know, you develop diabetes.
It just seems like a big entry, guns
for
just recreation,
and but that's a bit more disingenuous.
The gun trade
on its own is conditioned for more deaths.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly think it's something to be concerned about, but it does. I mean, it's one of the things. What are you going to say? I mean, if you don't tell the kids, don't play computer games.
It's an essential part of life, actually.
Yeah, but it's not just it's not of growing up.
It is. It's an essential part of growing up.
But having computer games, I don't know enough about it. But there must be different sorts of computer games.
Yeah. Oh, they're right.
There's something that parents do that monitoring makes it easier.
It's just like movies, you know, some of the documentaries and others are horrors. The effect of the mind is quite different. There's a lot of people involved in scripture compared to someone wondering how the chainsaw works. The effect of the mind is a little bit different.
So the rest of the computer game itself is not the problem. It's the thing. It's when you draw the line and this is too violent,
too
harmful. And that applies to any.
And they have, I mean, there are different degrees of it, you know. And because my friend Dustin is an avid computer gamer, so he's always kind of playing them. And so you have some where you don't just go to war and kill, but you actually build a society. So you kind of have to make decisions about allocating resources and building things as well as going to war. So it's kind of much more nuanced than just.
Being in the army is one of the.
Imagine King would be too happy with the moon if he said, "Oh yeah, go to war."
Okay, so where were we? Right, I'm just so confused with all these bloody things.
Okay,
so where are we going now? We're now at 5:15, so let's get to the Asalayana Sutta. So before we finish. Oops.
I'm in German.
Jen.
How's the German going?
She requested a sutta, and it just happens to be in German. So that's good. So Asalayana Sutta, here's the parallels. One in the Madhyama Agama, Sarvasivada. One loose sutta in the Taisho Canon, and a partial parallel in the Akotara Agama.
I just can't imagine the Buddha speaking German.
Okay, so here we have it. And where's the Pali here? Okay, so this is one of those ones where the Buddha has a discussion with the Brahmins. As have I heard on one occasion. Do you want to read it in German?
I can read it, but not very well.
Okay.
Not all this.
Okay. Okay. Now, at that time, 500 Brahmins from all over the place were staying in Savatthi, and they heard this. They heard that the ascetic Brahmana, the ascetic Gotama, describes purification for all the four castes. Who is there able to dispute him about this assertion? Now, on that occasion, Asalayana, the Brahmin student, was saying in Savatthi, young, shaven-headed, 16 years old. He was a master of the three Vedas, with their vocabularies, liturgy, phonology, and etymology, the histories as a fifth, skilled in philology and grammar, fully versed in natural philosophy, and in the marks of a great man. So these are standard list of the Brahmanical scriptures, which we find repeatedly all through these suttas. Okay.
The marks of a great man.
Hmm.
Is that the 32 marks?
32 marks, yeah. It's always said to be a Brahmanical scripture, even though there's actually no Brahmanical scriptures that mention it. Yeah. Right? And so the Brahmins went to him and said, told him about this, and then he said, okay, Asalayana said, this ascetic Gotama is one who speaks the Dhamma. Now those who speak the Dhamma are difficult to dispute with. I cannot dispute with the ascetic Gotama about this assertion. So, move down. Where are we now?
I've got the German English.
Yeah, okay.
I've got the Jinglish.
Is that the answer? Is it good?
I said, yeah. And those Brahmins discussed here, thus, Alasadhyana, the young Brahmin lives there in Savatthi, is only just with Sarantamani, has been dismissed by the teacher. 16 years of life, the master of the three Vedas and interpretations and interpretation. Interpretation, their volume. Morphology. And their legends. The chant and knowledgeable demonstrator.
Alright, well, that sounds
their
good.
Characteristics of a great world.
So, they went to him and they said, okay, you can do it. He said, I can't do it. They encouraged him again, and then he consented and he went with them. Sat down and said to the Blessed One. Okay, the Brahmins say, Brahmins are the highest caste, those of any other caste are inferior. Brahmins are the fairest caste, those of any other caste are dark.
Because the skin colour is also dark, right? Mm-hmm. It compares to the Brahmins.
It seems possibly a kind of a hangover from a racial connotation. So we saw before, looking in the history classes, about how there may be some idea that the Brahmins were associated originally with the Aryan peoples who came from the Caucasian region or something. So they may well have been, in the earlier times, lighter skin coloured. Mm-hmm. Whether that maintains to the present day is a different matter.
In the south, people are darker.
Yeah, there was recently some research done on that, and what they found was that, because there was always the idea that there was the kind of the movement of peoples and the darker skinned people moved down and so on, but there was some more recent research done on it, and they found that actually people all around the world, there's a similar spectrum of skin colour, which is basically related to your distance from the equator, and so the amount of sun that you're exposed to. So it seems that people actually change within a few generations, or not a few generations, but over maybe a few thousands of years or whatever, their skin colour changes depending on the amount of sun that they're exposed to. So that skin colour isn't necessarily a good guide to the kind of movement of peoples in ancient time.
Mm. Yeah. One time when I went to Sutasita, afterwards we went to visit the Sri Lankan family, and one of the little girls, the question she asked me was, why do some, people have dark skin, some of light, and I used that simile of the equator, where that was my kind of thing about evolution. And then I said, well, one day us, basically one day us Australians going to become like aboriginals.
Yeah, except makes it, if we wear suntan lotion, then maybe we won't need to. Okay, so they're dark, but kind of the interesting irony of it is when it says it's dark here, the word is tanha, which is the Pali pronunciation in Sanskrit is pronounced Krishna. So I say the Brahmins are white Krishna, the other ones are Krishna, which is a bit of a giveaway to the origin of Krishna as a god, that he possibly didn't originate among the Brahmins. They paint him as blue. He actually means dark, and probably originally meant that he was a black-skinned deity, but they paint him as blue just to kind of avoid that implication. Okay. Yeah, he's actually got a very special skin color. He's not just a kind of a black fella. Okay, so Brahmins alone are the sons of Brahma, the offspring of Brahma, born of his mouth, born of Brahma, created by Brahma, and heirs of Brahma. What does Gautama say about that? Okay, so then the Buddha's, how are we going for the German?
The Buddha's voice?
Yeah. Lay down?
Yeah.
You gave up to being? Is that? Yeah, this is here, yeah? What is the person, what does Gautama say? What does Herr Gautama say? The priester. Alright, okay. What do you reckon? And the Gautama Buddha said, now Asalayana, the Brahmin women are seen having their periods, becoming pregnant, giving birth, and nursing. And yet those Brahmins, though born from the womb, say thus, Brahmins are born from the sons of Brahma, the offspring of Brahma, born of his mouth, born of Brahma, created by Brahma, heirs of Brahma. Okay?
Well, we can say the same about Christians.
Yeah. So, okay, naturalistic response there. And then he says, repeats his assertion, still the Brahmins think thus, and so the Buddha replies, what do you think, Asalayana? Have you heard that in Yona and Kamboja and in other other borderland regions, there are two castes, masters and slaves, Ayocheva Dasocha, and that slave masters become slaves and slaves become masters? Have you heard that? Yes, I have heard that. Evam bho sutang tang me. Interesting here, this is an example of where the idiom evam me sutang, it's a little bit, syntax is a little bit shifted around, but it's basically the same phrase giving an idea of what evam me sutang actually meant. And it's often said that the meaning of it is that it means these are the words that Ananda heard from the Buddha's mouth. Okay, but that's clearly not exactly what it doesn't mean. What it means is, this is what I've heard. This has been passed down. This is what he's said. And there's another specific idiom. Samukhe Bhagavato Me Sutan Samukhapati Gahitan. I heard this from the Blessed One's own lips. Yeah, which is what you say when you definitely heard something from the Buddha himself. So when the sutta say Evam Me Sutan, what they specifically mean is, this is what has been passed down through the tradition. Doesn't mean this is what I heard myself right from that, from the source. Okay. It means that the castes aren't fixed in their natures, yeah. So that you can free your slaves, and then they can become
masters of free men and so on.
Yeah.
It's
interesting because that's actually what the rituals that used to happen
from the legal. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they make the slaves the masters of slaves. Yeah. Could be what it's called, talking about. They do it temporarily. So the Yonas, of course, being the Ionians, so the Greeks, and Cambodia, I'm not 100% sure where Cambodia is, but probably to the northwest region somewhere of India. What exactly Yona refers to here is a bit controversial, there's not any particular evidence for the presence of Greeks in India until maybe 100 years or so after this period. So many scholars argue that this statement must have been inserted at that time, after the invasion of Alexander, which is about 100 years after the Buddha. I don't find that argument particularly convincing. I mean, it just simply means that there's no kind of record. I mean, this is talking about a rumour that's been passed around. There's no reason why, you know, rumours and, you know, stories about distant lands shouldn't have passed down through trade routes and things like that. So, personally, I don't see any reason why that should necessarily be after the invasion of Alexander. And notice the word for master and saviour, ayah, related to, again, the word ayah that we've been using. And dasa is the ayah. It's the same ayah as we use for the nuns or for the monks.
Mm-hmm. I heard in Finland, the ayah is the slave.
Where?
That is the main in Finland. Is that right, Chandra?
Mm-hmm. Can we go down the page on the
journal? Ayah is the nursemaid.
I as a nursemaid, is that right? Yeah, I
do.
Okay, so then Salayana repeats his assertion. Then the Buddha says, what do you think? Suppose a katya were to kill. How are we going here from the German? Is that right? Suppose a katya, the warrior, noble caste, were to kill living beings, take what's not given, commit sexual misconduct, speak falsely, speak maliciously, speak harshly, gossip, be covetous, have a mind of ill will, and hold wrong view. Of course, being the 10 ways of unwholesome action. After death, would he go to a bad destiny and not a Brahmin? Or what about if it was a Vesa, a merchant, or a Sudda? I translate Sudda as a worker. What would happen to them? And they're the same thing. And Asalayana admits that for any of them, if they were well conducted, then they would go to heaven, and if not, then they'd go to a bad destiny. And so Asalayana still repeats his assertion. Then the Buddha keeps on going with his arguments. If a Brahman is only a Brahman capable of developing a mind of loving kindness. Or can anyone do that? When anyone from the four castes? He said no. Salayana says no. Whether a Katya, Brahman, or a merchant, or a worker, all of the four castes are capable of developing a mind of loving kindness. But he keeps on repeating his argument. And he says, what do you think? Is only a Brahmin capable of taking a bathing brush and bath powder, going to the river and washing off dust and dirt, and not a katya, a merchant, or a worker? Of course, this has been related to the idea of the ritual bathing. He says, no, anyone can do that. Then what are you talking about? And then he repeats his argument again. And he says, well, can anybody from any of the castes, or even an outcast clan, a trapper clan, a wicker workers clan, a Cartwright's clan, or a scavenger's clan, taken up a fire stick made from a dog's drinking trough, or from a pig's trough, from a dustbin, or from castor oil wood, and light a fire and produce heat? Okay? So any of those people will produce it. So, you know, even from the lowest, meanest castes, take the worst kind of wood, and when they light the fire, would it be possible? What kind of fire would it? Would it have a flame? Would it have colour and radiance? Could you use it for what fire is used for? Okay, so whether, no matter who produces it, then it's all fire.
Is this how you watch their rituals?
Yeah, exactly, yeah, the fire worship, yeah. How are we going for the fire down here?
Oh, we're away. I think it doesn't have the heat fibers. It's got the whole thing.
It's got the whole thing, yeah, it doesn't have.
Don't worry about
this. Yeah, here we go. There's the fire on. And still he continues on. So the Buddha says again. And the Buddha says again, what about a Kshatriya youth were to unite with a Brahmin girl? And a son was born from the union. Should a son born from a Kshatriya youth and a Brahmin girl be called a Kshatriya after the father or a Brahmin after the mother? Well, and that's a lot. So this is a really critical question. Yeah.
Kumari
is the girl, and Kumara is the boy. So Kumara is a boy, and here Kanya is another word meaning a girl or a maiden. Mm-hmm. Yeah, same meaning here. What should they hang on? Where are we? Okay, should a son born of their union be called a Kshatriya after the mother or Brahmin after the father? He could be called both. Okay. What do you think? Suppose a Brahmin youth were to unite with a Kshatriya girl and the son were to be born from the union. What should they be called? Kshatriya or Brahmin? Kshatriya after the mother or Brahmin after the father? He could be called both. So this is very interesting because there's the whole notion of lineage, patrilinear and matrilinear descent, and this is kind of one of the crucial ways of constructing society and questions like passing down of inheritance and all kinds of things are dependent on this. And yet he's, as a Brahmin student, he's quite open. He says, well, you could be either. You can sit at either. So then the Buddha continues. What do you think? Suppose a mare to be mated with a male donkey and a foal were to be born as a result. Should that foal be called a horse after the mother or a donkey after the father? Asalayana said, it is a mule, Master Gotama, since it does not belong to either kind. I see the difference in this last case, but I see no difference in either of the former cases. Okay. And then he asked a question about, what if there were two Brahmin students who were brothers, born of the same mother? One student studious and intelligent, and one neither studious nor intelligent. Which one would you feed first? And will you feed the studious and intelligent one first? And what if one was of good character? And what if one was of studious and intelligent, but immoral and of bad character? And one neither studious nor intelligent, but virtuous and of good character? Which would you feed first? On such occasions, Brahman would feed first the one who is neither studious nor intelligent, but virtuous and of good character. So the Buddha said, first, Asalayana, you took your stand on birth, and after that you took your stand on scriptural learning, and after that you've come to take your stand on the very ground that purification is for four castes as I describe it. When this was said, the Brahman student Asalayana sat silent and dismayed, his shoulders drooping and head down, glum, and with nothing to say. So there's the Asalayana Sutta. There's some other interesting things in the Asalayana Sutta as well, but I can't go into it too much. Alright. So another thing I'd like to just talk about.
Sorry, Bhante, before you go on, why did the Buddha ask the question about the horse and the donkey?
Well, the idea is that you've got this kind of idea of castes as being something which is very distinct. So you've got this whole kind of, you've got a Brahmin caste and a Kshatriya caste, and they're kind of completely distinct. But of course the reality is, of course, that nobody's going to respect those things, and people are going to be having babies that are mixed from Brahmin and Kshatriya, so what do you call them? Right. And so he sort of tracked him and said, well, you know, in that case, they're actually really neither Brahmin or Kshatriya. It's actually showing that those categories actually break down.
Right.
You know? But you have to make a decision, you have to make a sort of formal decision to call them one or the other.
Oh, so the Buddha was asking the third question because he was saying in the former question,
yeah,
to call both.
Yeah, but now it's actually, you like recognize actually, well, those categories of horse and donkey have now broken down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And this kind of thing is also found in the Brahmanical scriptures themselves. And so this is one of the, of course, that as soon as you have a system which is based on these very unrealistic ideas of lineage, like the ancient Brahmin system, and one perhaps might be forgiven for drawing some comparison with certain modern schools of Buddhist monastic thought, of course the reality is that it's much more complex and you can never pin it down to these kinds of things. So there's the famous or very important passage in the Upanishads where Satyakama is the one, the lover of truth, and he says, right, I want to go forth, I want to find a teacher and practice with him. So he goes to his mum. He lives only with his mum. He goes to his mum and says, oh mum, I need to know my father's name so I have my family name, because I'm going to go to this teacher and he'll ask me what my family name is. And the mother says, well son, you know how it is, when I was young I kind of got around a bit here and there, and you know, I have to admit that actually I don't quite know who your father is. So he then goes to see the Brahmin teacher, and the Brahmin teacher says, who's your father? And he says, well, you know, my mum got around a bit when she was young, she doesn't quite know who my dad is. And he says, oh well, only a true Brahmin could have said that. Yeah, only a true Brahmin could have been so honest. So obviously he must be a Brahmin. Yeah? So there you go. So the son of a, you know, she was like a maid, so she would have been a servant girl, and of an unknown father, but is adopted in the Brahmin caste and become a recognized teacher. So, okay. Which statement? Yeah. But in a sense, it's also showing that the word Brahman is used in not in a dissimilar sense to the way the Buddha used it. Yeah, it actually means, oh, you must be, you know, it's obviously very sincere. Yeah. So I'd just like to read one more passage. This one's sort of buried away somewhere in the middle of a long Diga Sutra, and I haven't been able to chase down the Pali. So I just got the English translation here, but this is quite a nice one, and I think quite important in the modern sphere of modern politics as well. This is from the Diga Nikaya, Kutadanta Sutta, the Madhiga 5. Sitting to one side, the Brahman Kutadanta, which means pointy tooth, maybe a vampire or something, I'm not sure. Address the Blessed One. Master Gotama, I have heard that you understand how to conduct successfully the triple sacrifice with its 16 requisites. Now, I don't understand all this, but I want to make a big sacrifice. It would be good if Master Gotama would explain this to me. Then listen, Brahman, pay proper attention, and I will explain. Yes, sir, replied Kutadanta, and the Blessed One continued. Of course, being a bit weird why a Brahman should be coming along to the Buddha to ask him how to do a sacrifice. Right? But anyway. And the sutra itself is very long and goes into quite a lot of details, but this is one of the nicest passages from there. He tells the story of the past. Once upon a time, there was a king called Mahavijita. He was rich, of great wealth and resources, with an abundance of gold and silver, of possessions and requisites, of money and money's worth, with a full treasury and granary. And when King Mahavijita was reflecting in private, the thought came to him, I have acquired extensive wealth in human terms. I occupy a wide extent of land which I have conquered. Let me now make a great sacrifice that would be for my benefit and happiness for a long time. And calling his chaplain, he told him his thought. I want to make a great sacrifice. Instruct me, venerable sir, how this may be to my lasting benefit and happiness. The chaplain replied, Your Majesty's country is beset by thieves. It is ravaged. Villages and towns are being destroyed. The countryside is infested with brigands. If Your Majesty were to tax this region, that would be the wrong thing to do. Suppose Your Majesty were to think, I will get rid of this plague of robbers by executions and imprisonment, or by confiscation, threats and banishment, the plague would not be properly ended. Those who survived would later harm Your Majesty's realm. However, with this plan, you can completely eliminate the plague. To those in the cattle who are engaged in cultivating crops and raising cattle, let Your Majesty distribute grain and fodder. To those in trade, give capital. To those in government service, assign proper living wages. Then those people being intent on their own occupations will not harm the kingdom. Your Majesty's revenues will be great, the land will be tranquil and not beset by thieves, and the people with joy in their hearts, playing with their children, will dwell in open houses. And saying, so be it, the king accepted the chaplain's advice. He gave grain and fodder to those engaged in cultivating crops and raising cattle, capital to those in trade, proper living wages to those in government service. Then those people, being intent on their own occupations, did not harm the kingdom. The king's revenues became great, the land was tranquil and not beset by thieves, and the people, with joy in their hearts, playing with their children, dwelt in open houses. Nice, huh? I think it may have some connection. Yeah, I think the Buddha was a bit of a social democrat in some ways, kind of program. So, I mean, it is just so interesting how that kind of wisdom, which is so straightforward, and still the prescription for today. You know.
But not just in times of economic downturn, but at all times.
Yeah.